Let's begin. Then I'll give some context. We'll have to adapt today. So, Heavenly Father, thank you for your mercies. I pray that you would visit us, teach us your word. We want to know and love you and serve you, and that by the power of the Spirit is the only way. So we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
So I don't know what quite happened. What went wrong? Something went wrong with the handouts. The handouts are printed and stapled front and back, but they're in random order. like the pages are in random order, and I don't even think the pages are all in the same order. Like it's not like they were all done in the same wrong order. So do you want it? Or do you want to be confused by it and work through it? And then, okay. Yeah, but I... Okay. That will help, but it is... Hey, man, it was put on the desk. I just... If you could pass these out, that would be great. Okay, as I was just saying, the handouts are all confused. So for those who just came in, they're in the wrong... Pages are in the wrong order, and weirdly... Not all of the particular handouts have them in the same wrong order. So that takes some extra special doing.
But the numbers in the lower right are the right numbers.
We think so. I mean, how would we know that? How would we know that at this point? I don't think we can be confident of anything.
The rest of us couldn't make the printer do that if we tried.
Well, I'm not going to say exactly what happened. So I think what we'll do, here's the thing. I know this is going to be crazy. Why don't we just, like, use the Bible? This is going to be, we'll see if this works. All right. Hey, we want to talk today about, so find page one. Well, I'll basically be on page one. We want to talk today about the Mosaic Covenant, which is the most famously controversial of the covenants. Both in the history of interpretation, but also in the New Testament. It becomes a point of conflict between the Judaizers. It also becomes a point of acute development, even with the faithful apostles. Peter, for example. Peter needs to be shown a vision, and the sheet needs to come down three times before he's ready to move on beyond the law of Moses, at least the liturgical ceremonial law of Moses, so we can start to see what a deeply embedded identity this covenant gave to the people of Israel. And then, of course, Acts chapter 15 is dealing with it, and the book of Galatians is dealing with it, and the book of Romans is still dealing with it in chapter 4. So here we are. We're going to deal with it. All right. So what I want us to do first is go to Exodus chapter 1, and I want us to see probably the most fundamental thing we could say about, let's say the most fundamental thing we can say about the law and the covenant with Moses is that it's deeply embedded and cannot be understood outside of the context of Abraham and the patriarchs. That's the whole beginning of Exodus chapter 1. Who can read those first 10 verses of Exodus chapter 1? Who can read those for us? I'll do it, since there's a bunch of names in here. You want me to do it?
Yeah.
These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all the generations died, but Israelites were fruitful and multiplied and greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become more, even more numerous. If war breaks out, we'll join our enemies and fight against us and leave the country. So let's identify some biblical context for that. Who is in Egypt from the very beginning? Who are they tied to? Those 12 tribes are what? They're Israel. They're the family. How many of them are there? This is, bear with me, but there's 70 that go down there, but then they become what? Innumerable. Does that sound familiar to you? Where do we learn that they would be innumerable? From the very beginning of the promise. And of course, we're talking about promises embedded in Genesis 12 and Genesis 15. And then the whole story from Genesis 37 to the end of the book, the whole story of Joseph, which leads them down there. And it covers, do you remember there was a period of time when God told Moses, when God told Abraham that he would come to the promised land, there was a period of time that would elapse. And this is going to be involved in that. It was those 400 years, or those four generations. We could talk about that, we just don't have time. When the sin of the Amorites was going to be fulfilled that we saw last week. So what we need to see, and we're going to see it very definitively in a moment, is that the book of Exodus, although it enters into this very new formulation and structure of the people of God, is in absolute clear terms, emphatically telling us that these are the people of the promise that were given to Abraham. Now, why do you think that's going to be important for our understanding of the law? How will that help us understand the law? I'm going to make this awkward silence continue for a while.
It gives us a covenantal context from the beginning.
Yeah. It becomes the interpretive horizon of whatever is going to happen on Mount Sinai. It's going to happen because of this. Now, what happens as we carry on to walk through the story, he wants the sons killed. They're not killed. The midwives are heroic. And not only are the midwives heroic, but one mother, Moses' mother, a Levite, a daughter of a Levite, or married to a Levite, she hides her son, and he becomes the deliverer. But I want us someone to read 2:23. I'm going to make someone read this through the end of the chapter.
I'll do it.
Yeah.
During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew.
Now that couldn't be more clear. The whole ethnic, covenantal context of the story of the book of Exodus is articulated more so narratively, so that any attentive student of any kind of storytelling would understand that the whole thing's being framed in the perspective of certain set of people, and would have remembered that from the preceding book of the Torah. But then this passage emphatically declares, why did God deliver Egypt, deliver the Israelites out of Egypt?
He
remembered his covenant with Abraham. So let's jump ahead to Exodus chapter 20. And we'll go by this again and again. And God spoke to all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Why did God bring them out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery? You know the answer because we just gave it. And so the preamble to the Ten Commandments is redemption. As I said a few weeks ago, when we get the Ten Commandments and its preamble define their place in the covenantal structure. If Moses came to Israel and he said, here are the Ten Commandments, get your head around these and then we'll go, then we would have an entirely different perspective on the law. Let's talk a little bit. Let's go back to Genesis, talk a little bit about Moses, chapter 3, and Moses and the burning bush. You know, Moses has the instinct of a redeemer. It doesn't work out very well. He kills a guy, okay, and then the Pharaoh finds out about it, so he's got to leave. And it's one of these 40-year segments in Moses' life. And at the end of that 40-year segment, he sees the burning bush. And I just want us to point out three questions. Look at verse 11. After he was told he would redeem them, he said, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out? What's God's answer to him? Who are you? That's one of those beautiful non-answers. You know, God's answer is, you know, he has three questions. First one is, who am I? And God says, well, you're the guy that I'm with. That's what you really need to know. But then he says, who are you? Look at verse 13. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is your name? What should I tell them? And what's his answer? I am who I am, the tetragrammaton, the ineffable name of God. But let's go down to 4 just to close this three-point sermon off. His first question is, who am I? The second question is, who are you? And the third question that every church leader should ask, what about them? Moses, in verse 4:1, and what if they do not believe me or listen to me? Well, he then accommodates and builds these things into God's law. Let's now builds these things into Moses' ministry. So we've set this up. I want to underline it by going to Romans chapter 4. So let's go up to the fullness of the revelation of Christ in Romans chapter 4. Or excuse me, I'm sorry, Galatians chapter 3. Paul says, this is from the NIV. Paul says, brothers, let me take an example from everyday life. Just as no one can set aside or add to a human covenant that has been duly established, so it is in this case the promises that were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. The scripture does not say to his seeds, meaning many people, but to your seed, meaning one person, the Christ. What I mean is this, the law, introduced 430 years later, does not set aside the covenant previously established by God and thus do away with the promise. For if the inheritance depends on the law, then it is no longer depends on the promise. But God, in his grace, gave it to Abraham through a promise. So why am I underlining this? Why do you think this is important? It's important for two reasons. What do you think they might be? What's Paul arguing about in Galatians? About how we what? About how we are saved. So that's the first reason it's important to place this in this covenantal context. Because Paul's argument in Galatians is that there is no other gospel. If you misunderstand the law, both ceremonially and morally, you will misunderstand the pathway to salvation. But there's also another reason. What's on the other side? We are saved, and then what is the journey of, what is our journey of our justification do? It should lead to what?
Sanctification.
It should then lead to sanctification. That's, if you're a Christian, that's my plan for you. Okay? If you're not a Christian, my plan for you is justification, and then we'll work on sanctification. But in order to understand both of those principles, we have to know where the law of God comes. We're not going to dig into it just right now, but the rest of that chapter is really talking about how the law leads us to Christ, and then a lot of Galatians is about not only justification, but sanctification. So what we've done so far in the first few minutes is we've placed the law in the covenant context. We've understood from that it's born of the promises to Abraham, and everything that happens with the law is wrapped in that envelope. And then we've gone to Galatians chapter 3, and we could have done the same thing in Romans chapter 4. We've done that to show that it touches clearly within the context of justification and sanctification. So let's now talk about the law itself. Find page 2, wherever your page 2 is. Find page 2. Now, I want to talk about how law worked, what laws looked like before the law of God came in its fullness. And we can see that in the age of the patriarchs. The law of God in creation in the patriarchal era. We talked about stipulations, the covenants with Adam at the beginning, and then Adam and Eve after the fall, and then Noah and Abraham. They all had what we called were stipulations. Who can remember from any one of those covenants what those stipulations were? Just an example. What's that?
To walk in my ways.
Walk in the ways, yeah. Perfect obedience. There are some more concrete versions of to circumcise your sons on the sixth day. Noah had a big one. What was Noah's? To build a giant boat. That was part of the covenant. Adam and Eve at the very beginning were told not to do something. What was that? To eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So what I want us to see is that law is not new. Even an external law is not new in the idea of covenant. That there was, in the ancient Near East, your religious mores were bound to one's God. If you were in covenant or relationship with God, here's a radical idea for 21st century Christianity. That meant you did what your God said, no matter what. So the idea of law, both covenantal law, as stipulated in all those things we've mentioned, but also natural law. You know, Paul in Romans chapter 2 says, where's the law of God written? And he's talking about all people, not just Jews or believers. Now, by the way, that didn't start when Paul wrote Romans. That's been the case all the way back through human history. And so what's often spoken of is that there is either a natural or an internal expression of the law of God. It's not as fully formulated. But in Moses, what people like Robertson say and others, is that in Moses, the law gets elaborated and externalized. You can see that, can't you? Because that's what makes the covenant with Moses so starkly different and raises so many questions for us. First of all, how many commandments are there? There's 10, but there's kind of 10, but there's actually a lot more than 10 because they get elaborated on. And they get also apparatus to enforce their obedience. So there is an acceleration, an externalization, and an elaboration on the role of law in the people of God in the covenant with Moses. And so we're starting to see that. The tablets, who can go to, let's see what I meant when I said 34:28 of Exodus. Let's see what I was talking about.
Breaking the two tablets.
Yep. Let's go to 27. Then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. Moses was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights without eating bread or drinking water. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. That is the manifest externalization of the Decalogue. Decalogue, you'll hear the Ten Commandments. A lot of you, maybe most of you have heard the word Decalogue. That means 10, Decalogue words, the 10 words. And they're now articulated in their fullness in an external way. And that is fundamental. Now, let me ask you this. Is that the only way Moses conceived of the law of God? No, because he talked about the law of God written on our hearts and a circumcised heart, and that's not all, but that's really at the center of the book of the law. And the book of the law is found throughout the New Testament. I mean, the Old Testament. It will get lost, it will be found, it will spark revivals. Who can go to, let's go to 2 Kings 23. Josiah's reform. After the book of the law was found, then the king called together all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem. He went up to the temple of the Lord with the men of Judah, the people of Jerusalem, the priests and the prophets, and all the people from the least to the greatest. He read in the hearing of the word of all the words of the book of the covenant. Now, what do you think the book of the covenant is? Well, we're going to find out. Go to Exodus chapter 20. The book of the covenant is, you can see it outlined there, Exodus 20 through 24. You want to know this. And it's considered, if you look at its structure, it's pretty clearly independent structure of a covenant document that begins with the Ten Commandments and then elaborates them. And then in chapter 24. What do you see in chapter 24? You see a renewal ceremony and a reaffirmation or an affirmation of the covenant. We're going to look at the middle of it in just a minute. But the covenant is confirmed then with sacrifices. Remember what we said at the very beginning? A covenant is a bond in blood sovereignly administered. It's a solemn oath ritualistically enacted. And so let's just take a look. It's probably easier just to look at this handout I gave you on page 3 we're on now. There's a prologue, the summary of the law. There's an altar erected, some general instructions about life and the covenant. Then it's broken down into sections, more or less social and civil laws, religious and moral laws, and then finally a covenant ratification. So when Josiah found the book of the law, probably was encompassed with a number of other texts around it. But when he's reading the book of the law, he's certainly reading these middle chapters of the book of Exodus. And that becomes the heart of the covenant of Moses. And there's some peculiar laws in there. Like, what's the deal about not boiling a young goat in its mother's milk? What do you think's up with that? We'll come back to that later. So no one who didn't go to seminary even thinks about that until it's brought up. So, let's go to chapter 4. I mean, chapter 4, page 4. So we talked, last week, we talked about the relationship of covenants and ritual to the ancient Near East cultures around them. Does anybody remember that discussion about, I hope so, because it was like 7-8 days ago. So we talked about how it is that this cultural manifestations and religious manifestations relate to the religious cultural manifestations of the pagan world around them. And there's a couple ways to look at that. One is that there could be no relationship. The other is that, oh, the Israelites are just making up stuff and just copying people around them. And the preferred choice is that the human condition understands ritual, religion, and the necessity of sacrifice across all ages, which is why like a 1,000,000,000% of the people in the world are religious people of some kind, because it's inherent to our condition. And so a guy named Meredith Klein, who's heard of Meredith Klein? He is most famously known for inventing hyphenated words. The guy hyphenates more words than any other Christian in history. And also, we know that because he edited and published his own books, because a real editor would have told him to quit it with the hyphenations. But he didn't have that. But he was also brilliant, and one of the things he did was he helped us understand how the covenants, especially here at this point, they fit this formula. So who can read 1 and 2 of chapter 4, these structures? Yeah.
Right now?
Yes, please. Suzerain. That's like the Lord, the Master, the Boss Man. Sorry, I tricked you.
Number 2, an historical prologue emphasizing past acts of benevolence. And number 3, an extensive delimiting of stipulations involving both demands for heart loyalty and requirements for specific action.
Keep going, you're on a roll.
Provisions for the official depositing of duplicate copies of the treaty documents in the presence of the respective gods of vassal and voivode.
Suzerain.
Suzerain.
Boss man. We'll just say boss now.
Okay. An invocation of witnesses, often involving the summoning of inanimate objects, and a statement of potential curses and blessings related to covenant fidelity.
Boom. So we're going to call him the final boss. Isn't that a thing in gaming? I don't care. Much too spiritual to game. Oh, sorry, Aaron. You make a living on gaming. I shouldn't have said that. And no, believe me, I'm not against the gamers. So, do you recognize any of those things in the Bible? These are all drawn from ancient Near East covenants, all beyond with many other suzerains and many other gods. Well, let's look at this one. Provisions of depositing a duplicate of duplicate copies and treaties and of documents in the presence of respective gods of vassal and suzerain. What does that sound like?
One of the first commandments.
Yeah.
Well, thou shalt have no other gods before me.
Exactly. So it isolates him, says this is the one God, the true God. Let's talk about, so the temple is the courts where the water basin is and the altars are. Then there's the holy place where the showbread is and the light. And then what's inside that? The Holy of Holies. And what's inside the Holy of Holies?
The Ark.
The Ark. And what's inside the Ark?
Two tables of the law.
What's that? Do you see?
Staff.
Yeah, and a staff. And there's, you know, we can go on and on about that, but what I want to focus, well, not on and on because there's not all that much, but the I want to focus on that when Israel is embedding the law at the Lord's commandment into the presence of God, that is the solemnization and the dedication of the covenant, just as honestly any ancient Near East person would have understood what that was doing. It really raises some questions about what it means to be distinct and about Israel's relationship to the word, to the worlds around them. I would just say this, it's impossible not to be enculturated.
Yeah.
You cannot not be enculturated. In fact, one of my pet peeves about our own tradition is that even many in the PCA today they actually articulate that whatever happened in 17th century Scotland was so transcultural that it wasn't really influenced by the temperament and the values and the structures of Northern Scotland, which has never, it is an existential, by the way, I love all that stuff, but I'm not going to act like it was not, that none of it came up out of the ground, that it only came down from heaven. It certainly came out of the Bible, but there's just impossible not to enculturate. And I don't want to, well, first of all, that can be done very, very poorly. I mean, we know that. It can also be done well, but it can't not be done. So copies, invocations, remember the end of Deuteronomy? Some people are on one hill pronouncing blessings and they're on the other hill pronouncing curses. We're going to do that probably in January here in the sanctuary. We're going to have one side just declare all the curses and the other side declare all the blessings.
Dibs on the blessings.
Yeah, I got the what?
Dibs on the blessings.
Dibs on the blessings. Haven't cleared this with the elders yet, but I got a big plan. We'll see if they approve it or not. But so we're just starting to get a sense of and why this is important. So, any questions about the relationship of the structure of the covenant elements to the culture around it? What we're trying to see is it's connected. We're trying to see it's connected and grows out of and is in harmony with Abraham. We next want to see that it's got a core structure that is elaborated on, but I think it is important for us to understand that the book of the law is referring to the book of the covenant. The book of the law can be a little different. Is these four verses or chapters? Because if you were with Israel at the Ten Command, when the Ten Commandments were given, you would have walked through this whole process and you would have understood what you're doing. You would have understood that you're making a covenant with your God, and it's binding spiritually, culturally, in these other ways. Any questions about that? All right, so let me ask you this question. How are the people of God different after Moses gave the law than before? I don't mean like personally, existentially, but what about their shape? What looks different about the people of God after Moses than before Moses?
Their relationship with God becomes mediated.
Yeah.
They're no longer offering sacrifices directly.
Exactly. So that's down to that second point. Who is making sacrifices in the age of the patriarchs? Like if you were a Jew, a child of Abraham, who made all the altars in the book of Genesis? The patriarchs did. The fathers did. Who circumcised or made sure that, well, they probably did circumcise. Who circumcised the children? The fathers did. So there's this patriarchal system is moving from paternal to priestly. You can also see that it's moving from tribes to a nation. And the nation is formalizing itself. We're going to see the kinds of laws here in a minute. But this is a tectonic evolution of the people of God in the story of Moses. They are, in a manner of speaking, the people of God are being institutionalized. And there are structures set up in all of its religious, social, and civil aspects. And that is significant. What we're going to do eventually, look at from nation to kingdom, when do the people of God move from nation to kingdom? It's not in this covenant. Which covenant do you think it will be in? In the Davidic covenant. Although in Deuteronomy chapter 17, Moses makes a provision for the coming king. So it's not, you know, even, despite the fact that Israel picked the wrong guy for the wrong reasons, you know, or, you know, I guess God picked him, but just to mess with him, Saul, that this was embedded. This evolution was embedded. We talked about the scriptures being organic, but progressive. They're organic because they're, it's really one story. What do I mean by progressive? And I'm not using that in this political terms. The story is organic because it's one story. What do you think I mean by it being progressive?
Build on each other.
Yeah. So you can see from Adam and Eve to Noah to Abraham and now to Moses. And the last thing I want to say is that the next thing I want to say is that the land is typologically aligned to the covenant. There's something unique about the land and the law in the covenant of Moses. What will happen to Israel if they breach the law of Moses after they're in the promised land? What will happen to them? They will be exiled. And that exile is directly related to the civil law, the moral law, and the ceremonial law. So we can just take a look at this. Now, this is the commandment, the statutes, the rules. This is in, on page 4 at the bottom. That the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, and that you may do them in the land to which you are going over to possess it, that you may fear the Lord your God and your son and your son and your son's son by keeping all of his statutes and commandments, which I command you all the days of your life. Hear, O Israel, and be careful to do them, that it may go well with you and that you may multiply greatly as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. There is a typological connection between Israel's obedience and their participation in the blessings of the land, which could sound like, and often does, if you're not careful reading it, if you don't understand those first two chapters, it sounds like if the promised land is a type of what? The promised land is a type of what? Ultimately, when all things are said and done, it's a type of the new heavens and the new earth. It's a picture of the new heavens and the new earth. And if you're not careful, this is why I was underlining those first two chapters. If you're not careful about contextualizing how this whole covenant started, you will, like some of our dispensationalist brothers, especially in the last century did, you will understand that God changed his approach from salvation by grace, the righteous will be declared by faith you'll be declared righteous, Genesis 15:6, to like, all right, let's try to do the law now. But what's going on is there's a didactic function of the law in the book of Moses. He is teaching the people of God that ultimately their participation in the promised land and God's fellowship with them and his blessings on the produce of the promised land, ultimately that's connected to someone's obedience. And obviously they, like us, will fail. I wish I had loaded these up, but my brain's not remembering them. But you understand, you'll remember, just like survey in your mind all your Old Testament reading, there will be these pictures in the Psalms and other places that with God's blessing and with the obedience of his people, the trees will clap and the harvest will be bountiful and God will bless us and will overflow. I'm thinking Psalm 65 does this. This is what it's talking about. There will be, God is not going to let the world produce its fruit while it's in rebellion against him. And so the people of God go to the promised land, and God, in his patience for 400 years, lets them screw it up. But finally, ultimately, who secures that blessing for us?
Christ
secures that blessing for us. Out of Egypt, remember what it says in Luke, Matthew? Out of Egypt I brought my son. And who's the son? That's Jesus in the book of Matthew. And Jesus came and he aligned the spiritual, moral, liturgical reality of the law of God with creation. And that's why Jesus can bring the new heavens and the new earth into their manifest reality. because he's the only one that did it. So that's how, when you read those, it's very real. The Israelites would have understood this is not just a picture. God's not just making an analogy. They got expelled from the promised land. Be with you in a second. They got expelled from the promised land. Don't get fooled by that. Understand the bigger redemptive story. Henny.
Doesn't this also relate to Hebrews, I think it's chapter 4, that where it says Jesus was heir to the whole world because of his obedience?
Yeah.
Not just the land, not just this piece of land.
Yeah, the whole thing.
The whole thing.
The whole thing.
This was just a type of something much bigger, the whole world.
It is. The promised land is a type of the whole created order. And actually, you could also go backwards. Not only is it a type of the new heavens and the new earth, but let's go back in time. Let's go back in redemptive time. For you, it would be this way. And what is it also a picture of? The Garden of Eden. Actually, Hebrew goes this way, so I was right the first time. It would have been back here. So this is a theme all the way through, which is, we could go on, but this is why Jesus is tempted in the desert. You know, there's so much going on here. So let's take a look now at the kinds of law that we have. Any questions about that? Anything else? Thanks, Annie. All right. Oh, sorry.
I don't see anything that they have done extraordinary in obeying God's law or going after the new Messiah.
Yeah.
Why are they coming back to the promised land?
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm going to need my eschatology charts to help you answer that question. No. I won't. You know what? I'm going to say that I don't know. I'm just going to be my answer. I would say this, though. I am not of the Reformed opinion that Israel no longer has any historic or redemptive significance in God's plan. I mean, I don't think we can read Romans 11 that way, which talks about us being grafted in and a renewal. So, what that means about the return of Israel to the promised land in 1948, after World War II. I'm not ready to exactly integrate that into an eschatological timetable, because I think those things are just, like, we're told not to really timeline that stuff. But I would say that it's significant. I also, especially with relationship to the October 7th war, you can find a lot of folks online doing all kinds of stupid stuff. But one of them is this pretty lame claim that, well, they're not even the people of God. How do we know they're the people of God? You know, I find that pretty weak sauce. You know, there has been a continuity of, it's amazing. I don't know of any other ethnic group who has sustained integral continuity and culture without a homeland for 2,000 years in their history. That's why there's no, that's why it's really hard to find an Assyrian. You know, so yeah.
Chaldean.
Or Chaldeans. So, I believe the Gentiles in here. Were you saying something a minute ago?
5,000. More like 5,000.
Yeah, more like 5,000, yeah. Well, I think that's something. I think we're called the new Israel. I think we're the sons and daughters of Abraham, the Gentiles are. But I think we're engrafted, and we're actually told, because we're engrafted, we're told not to get arrogant and assume that God has no purpose for them. So, yeah, that's kind of the best I can do with that. You know, there's a lot of history. You know, I could make some comments that would get me in trouble, but I won't.
Well, in the passage you reference, Romans 11, Paul even says, he begins by saying it's a mystery.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not sure we can completely nail the whole thing down.
Yeah, nail the whole thing down. I do think that a renewal of faith among the people of God from Romans 11 it will indicate that there's an imminent closing of the age, and I long for that. I don't think Israel's innocent of it, you know, all crimes because of that, but I do think, I will say this, honestly, I think the persistent anti-Semitism in the world, including the church's anti-Semitism against Israel, is actually in a very peculiar way one of the evidences of the reality of the covenant and the people of God and the gospel. That's not to say they've never done anything bad, but super crazy that like 0.3% of the world gets that much hate. I don't think it's accidental.
I have a coworker who's a Jew, and she was very distraught with all this going on, and you know, lunch tables. I was saying, I don't know why they are doing. Why so many people hate us this much?
Yeah.
So it's a very real question, and like, I think we have some things in the Bible.
Yeah.
It talks about some of these. And
yeah.
So I think God is actually making them to regroup and refocus.
Yeah, and you know, and then back to the church. We're going to talk about in the next weeks. We're going to talk about Israel's rejection of the Messiah, and how they killed the righteous one and the author of life. And you know, Luther and others have used that as a springboard for some very severe evil. So we have to be careful about it. But yeah, that's the. I'm going to get out of here while the getting's good. Oh no.
We talked about this in a small group. What you're articulating, I think, is the dispensationalist side is you ascribe to Israel's return some spiritual significance and to the land, right?
Yeah.
The other is there's absolutely no significance to the fact that ethnic Israel still is around and has returned by chance to historic home. What you're articulating, I think, what Romans 11 conveys is there's this mysterious notion that God is still going to do something at the end of the age with this group that is ethnically related to the people who occupied that land thousands and thousands of years ago.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what it says.
I think that's what it says, too.
Restoration is somehow the valley of dry bones coming, because that's not true. They're rather believing people.
Yeah.
But there's some spiritual significance.
I think it's significant, And some of my pastoral mentor thought it was he was not a dispensationalist, but he thought it was of very significant eschatological import that they came back, and maybe we'll find that it is. But, All right, let's look at the three types of law. Moral law, ceremonial law, and the civil law. Moral law. Take a look at this. The 10 words summarized in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. It's permanent and universal. In other words, there's no time in which murder and adultery, there's no covenant structure that can be erased, that put those out. Not limited to Israel, reflects God's nature. I would say both, who knows what the two tables of the law are? So you guys recognize that language? Can someone articulate for us what those are?
The first table regulates our relationship vertically between God and man, and the second table is horizontally.
Exactly. So those are the two tables of the law. And sometimes you'll hear people say, well, the prophets, although they call out the nations, they don't call out the nations for the front table of the first table of law. They call them out for the second table of law. And a close reading of Isaiah and others, no, that's not the case. They're called out for their idolatry. For the heavens declare the glory of God, and we're suppressing what we know to be true about him. So the moral law, as we'll see in a minute, continues. Ceremonial law, usually, well, almost always in the New Testament, when you're hearing arguments about the law, and whether it's still valid, and an apostle is saying it's no longer still binding to, at least to Christians, it's talking about the ceremonial law, sacrificial system, dietary laws, festivals, priesthood, tabernacle regulations, and that sort of thing. It was temporary. It was to teach us about our atonement. It was symbolic. And it was ultimately, as Hebrews 10 especially says, fulfilled in Christ. And then the civil law, remember what we said, Israel moved from a tribe to a what? Remember that a few pages ago? To a nation. And a nation had instituted not only laws, but processes by which laws would be enforced. And that's the 40 lashes, that's the death penalty, that's restitution for stealing. You have to return plus some of what you stole. And those are the three types of law. The civil law, well, let's go, first of all, the moral law is still binding. Right. You can find that Paul says that love is the fulfillment of the law. James says the law is the law of freedom. You know, you have not, if you think the gospel means you don't have to obey God's law, Rebecca will reach out to you and you'll set up an appointment and we'll sit in my office for a little while and study the Bible together. You ready for that, Rebecca? No. No, in all sincerity, if you have questions about that, I'd be glad to, we can just have coffee or something if you don't want to go right into the, sit in the pastor's study, and that's scary. But we can do that. That's still binding. But did it ever serve a function? Did the law ever serve a function to save you?
What?
To save you. No, the law never saved you. That's what Paul says over and over again. The law never saved you. It was always a guide to how you should live. That's exactly where it came from. Now, the civil law is getting a lot of press lately because of our friends over in Moscow. You know, so they want to, you know, they and some others want to reestablish the civil law. But I want to go down to by the way, Christian, yeah, Moscow, Idaho. Sorry, not Moscow. Putin? Putin, sorry. Thank you. That's why you need elders in the room. Let's go to number 4 in the Westminster Confession of Faith here. To them also, that is Israel, the law was given as a body politic, and he gave sundry judicial laws, which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any others under any now further than the general equity thereof may require. That's a really important phrase in our confession of faith. That section says that we're not obligated, and in fact, in some cases, we can make an argument that we couldn't execute all of or apply all the civil laws, but somebody take a stab, some brave soul take a stab at what the divines meant by the general equity thereof.
I think you're just talking about the way we use the principles of those laws. And even in WCF and other sections, as a way to sort of extrapolate and use casuistry to say,
yeah,
here are the ways in which these principles apply to the society that we're living in.
Exactly. Now. Exactly. Lex talionis, the law of proportionality or retaliation, an eye for an eye. Mm-hmm. Gandhi famously and frustratingly said, an eye for an eye, and pretty soon what? The whole world is blind? Okay, well, I want to say this about that. Actually, lex talionis is meant to confine punishment, not exaggerate it. That if you've done a thing, let's pick on my buddy here, if you've done something wrong, the general equity there of the law is that your punishment should be directly proportionate to the measure of your offense. And we can get all kinds of examples of that from, there's also Deuteronomy says, if you have a house with a roof on it that you let people onto the roof, what are you supposed to do?
Have a railing around it.
Yeah, have a railing around it. What's the general equity thereof? general equity thereof is that here on our property, we have a fiduciary responsibility not to let it become unsafe for its common use. That's our responsibility. And also, if you hurt someone and wound them in an accident, you have to repay them. Does that sound like tort law to you? So that's why if I cause an accident, I'm responsible to restore as much as possible to the people that I wasn't paying attention to when I was driving. These are all grounded in the general equity thereof. Yes?
In the illustration about the raining, in Geneva, there are external staircases, and every year a few children would die because they would fall off the staircases.
In Geneva, you said?
Yeah, Geneva. Yeah. And Calvin used that law to say, you must put railings up on the staircases.
Yeah.
You might say that's common sense, but no, it wasn't. They just allowed children to die every year. And so what Calvin said, put the railing on the stairways, and he based it on that law.
Yeah, and you know, that reminds me of another. Calvin insisted on a redesign of wood-burning stoves in Geneva to make them safer for that exact kind of reason. So listen, man, raise your hand if you think that the bureaucratic state, I mean, we're trying to sell property, and man, they got like way too many rules. Like, I'm just going to say, okay? So they go, wait, yeah, can I get a witness from the property committee? So, but the idea of no rules is also not, like, no structure to that. That's not a biblical view. Now, I think there can be too many, but zero? No. In fact, if you ever go to a part of the world that has no zoning laws, you will start to appreciate your zoning laws. Yes?
One of the big differences that sometimes kind of gets buried in this, with that transition from tribe to nation, that even for, you know, Lex Talionis, there's this sense of prior to that things may have been tit for tat, right? With even escalation, because there was no third party charged with mediating that, and that instead it was like, you know, you just go the route of the Hatfields and McCoys.
Exactly, and there was no, which we said in the Noahic covenant that if a man sheds a man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, that implicitly indicated that there would need to be some institution to moderate that and to determine it. So, all right, that's what we got time for today. Thank you for navigating the handouts, and we'll go. Look forward to seeing you in worship.
Bless you.